Hello and welcome to this week's Herb Digest podcast. I'm William Law, editor of the Digest. Herb Digest is something of a rarity in Middle East analysis. Our daily newsletter has no sponsors, and we carry our podcasts without any advertising. It's our subscribers who support Herb Digest, and we intend to keep it that way. To find out how you can support a truly independent voice in the Middle East and North Africa, head to ArabDigest.org. When you go to the website, check out how you can receive our reader-supported daily newsletter for 2 months for free. You heard that right. 2 months for free. My guest today is Renaud Mansour. Renaud is a senior research fellow, Middle East and North Africa program, and the project director of the Iraq Initiative at London's Chatham House think tank. Renaud, great to have you back on the podcast.
It's great to be back, Bill.
In a recent analysis of foreign affairs, you critique the way the U.S. is managing its efforts to contain the so-called axis of resistance. I want to ask you what Washington has got wrong. But before I do, can you just remind our listeners what the axis of resistance is?
Well, the axis of resistance is a network of armed groups across Iran, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, groups that see themselves as resisting or fighting against Israel and American, you know, imperialism, colonialism in the Middle East. So these are groups such as Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Popular Mobilization Forces, Al-Hashd al-Sha'bi, in Iraq and in Syria, as well as the Houthis in Yemen. And these groups have sort of strong, close ties with Iran, and they very much see themselves as part of this, the frontline resistance against, you know, Israel, against the U.S., but also in sort of recent context, especially in support of the Palestinian cause in the region.
Okay, thank you for that. So what has America got wrong then?
Well, you know, these groups have existed for quite some time. They have penetrated and become quite influential in the governments of these countries, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Yemen. On the ground, they very much are in different ways performing the state, almost becoming, you know, state actors. And all this to say that they have been quite become quite powerful. At the same time, the U.S., especially in recent memory, has pursued certain policies that it has hoped, that Washington has hoped would diminish the power of these groups. So Washington has sanctioned many of their banks and businesses. Washington has killed many of their leaders, including, for example, the killing of Qasem Soleimani, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps commander, who was very much almost a godfather type for this axis. But also in January 2020, at the same strike, killing Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis, who was the leader of the PMF, the sort of Iraqi group within the axis. So yeah, so the U.S. have killed leaders. They've sanctioned the banks. They've also tried to create parallel forces in these countries that could kind of do the work that these groups are doing. But none of these policies have been working. You know, it's over 4 years since that monumental U.S. decision to kill Soleimani and Muhandis. And these groups are still there, and they're, you know, probably more powerful than they were. So, you know, when I wrote this article for Foreign Affairs, the question that I was trying to tackle was, A, why is the U.S. just fundamentally unable to really address these issues? And the answer to that was because there is a structural problem, and the U.S. just doesn't have the tools to have a coherent strategy across many of these countries to really move towards something more accountable in the future for the region.
Yeah, and you end the article by calling for the U.S. and its allies to support civil society movements. But Renaud, if we look at Iraq, for example, the militias, as you point out in the article, are so deeply embedded and entangled in the political and economic structures that, you know, with the best will in the world, how can outside players have any meaningful impact?
That's the question. You know, I work at Chatham House, which is a think tank based in the UK, and Our job is basically to not just make sense of what is trying to make sense of what is happening in the Middle East, but also to then have to give policy recommendations, advice, implications to UK, US, European stakeholders who in any case have programs in these countries. And, you know, the reality is that most of their programming won't actually reach an end state in terms of building states that are coherent, that are representative, that are, you know, in a way accountable. We know this won't happen, but nonetheless, these programs are there, and the US, UK, European countries have policies in the region. So I guess the first point of the article was, okay, how are current policies actually not just not fit for purpose, but actually sometimes backfiring and creating an even worse outcome for Europeans and others interested in building states in these countries or creating coherent states? And then the second point was, you know, the really when you look across these countries and we think about that idea of accountability, right? Because at the end of the day, that is the problem here. It's not that we have groups that don't look like states in the way we want to, or that have this sort of ideology or that ideology. The fundamental problem is that these groups have impunity and they're not accountable. The institutions are not there to kind of uphold the rule of law. And so that has to be the focus. And really, in the region, the only groups of you know actors, let's say, that we've seen in different ways try to bring about accountability in a meaningful way have come from civil society, have come from the region's young, you know, who live there, who see no other future, and who are trying in different ways every day still to change the course, the trajectory of their countries, and the fact that all of these groups exist. And so, you know, as we're thinking through solutions or potential alternatives, really one of the only ways that we can see accountability, which is so important, emerging or becoming a thing in these countries is through the civil society movements there. And I think you're right, these movements have been repressed quite violently in some of the countries. And it's not going to be easy. And this is not a short term, you know, this won't happen in a year or two, but really it's that demographic and that youth that is where we're seeing the biggest signs of genuine, meaningful accountability. Of course, the politicians in these countries, the armed groups themselves say, we're Democrats, we're pro-democracy, we're pro-accountability, but we haven't actually seen anything coming from that side. We've seen it much more from the bottom up.
Yeah. And then we come to 7th of October, which again, is complicated and already fiendishly complicated landscape. Because the last time we had you in was just a few weeks before that attack. Now, I wonder, Renan, what impact is the Gaza war having? And do you anticipate that, for example, if Netanyahu proceeds with the Rafah offensive, and the signs are that he will, that the axis of resistance, which of course, as you said, includes Iraqi PMF militias, might that axis kick into a major offensive of its own?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the post-October 7th environment in the region is very different. Of course, this has been a monumental shift in the trajectory, and Hamas's attack and Israel's response and Israel's continued war on Gaza has had ripple effects, obviously, across the region. First and foremost, of course, to the Palestinians who are being killed every day in Gaza and elsewhere, but also, of course, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, many countries have become affected by it. The spillover has been quite significant. And you have had the kind of heating up of this conflict. On one side, you have the axis of resistance, which we've been talking about, which is trying to kind of form the front line of the defense of the Palestinians. And on the other side, you have Israel and its supporters, the US government, the UK, European governments that are defending Israel and actually supporting Israel in its onslaught in Gaza. What this means, you know, we've seen an escalation. We've seen, you know, certain things that we haven't really seen before. Direct fire between Israel and Iran, right? So we've been talking about the axis, but we've also reached a new stage where these countries are actually firing on each other. We've seen Jordan, for example, in the middle of this shoot down Iranian attacks that, you know, in a way to stopping them from reaching Israel. So there's all sorts of dynamics in the Middle East that have escalated since October 7th. On the question of what this means for the axis of resistance, there's a tension. Many of the groups within the axis of resistance are domestically inclined. And what I mean by that is, yes, the Palestinian cause is ideologically an important symbol, but in real terms, what they are interested in is the day-to-day governing within their countries. So Hezbollah is concerned first and foremost now with how to maintain public authority in Lebanon. The Hashid, most parts of the PMF, are interested first and foremost in how to govern today in Iraq. And likewise, to some, you know, to some extent as well, the Houthis in Yemen. So the sort of post-October 7th reality has meant that these groups have to present themselves in this transnational way of fighting a conflict that goes beyond their borders, but they still don't want the instability because the instability can impact what they're doing domestically. And that tension is very real. And that has led to an almost reluctance to go into a direct war. Of course, none of them want to get into a direct conflict with Israel, but nonetheless, they have to be seen as responding when Israel attacks them, in a way. And they also have to be seen as attacking the US and Israel to maintain the ideological point that they are defending Palestinians. So it's a very delicate balancing act. But what we've seen really, I think, is that the domestic is still to them, to most of the groups, far more important than the transnational Palestinian cause or even the sort of axis cause.
Yeah, that's interesting. As you say, that balancing act. Because I'm thinking on the other side, the Americans are pushing hard, as we are here in the UK, for that Rafah offensive not to go ahead. And, you know, Netanyahu is a bit of a gambler. He may be thinking, well, you know, the axis of resistance, they're not, as you just pointed out, they're not going to want to risk what they have. So maybe I will go ahead and defy the Americans. It's going to be an interesting one to watch. And, you know, again, we all sort of hold our breath. But let me just move away a little bit from Gaza, if I may, and I want to ask you about environmental issues. Now, at last autumn's Iraq Initiative Conference, which you chaired brilliantly, by the way, the Iraqi climate envoy, Farid Yassin, spoke about the massive environmental and health damages caused by flaring off. That's the practice of burning off rather than capturing gas from oil fields. He called for action, and he pointed out that action could include some massive economic benefits. I'm just wondering, 6 months on, has any action been taken, do you know?
It's a difficult one. You know, as I think as we discussed last time on here, Iraq is one of the top five countries in the world that is most vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. And there's a reason for that, right? The reason for that is partly because of the decades and decades of conflict that the country has faced since the 1980s. But another reason to that is the political system and primarily, you know, specifically the corruption that governs every day in Iraq. That corruption is the ultimate impediment to many of these initiatives. So, you know, the climate envoy, Farid Yassin, is very much dedicated and has ideas as what needs to be done. But, you know, enacting and operationalizing those ideas would require not just technical expertise, which they're bringing together, but the ability to navigate the networks of power, the networks of corruption that benefit from the wealthy Iraqi state. And so, you know, to answer your question, we have not seen much progress and we don't expect much progress in the short term, certainly, because it's a tall order. It's a very uphill, you know, climb for Iraq to try and move from that technical awareness of the problem to really that political question, right? And that how can we politically start ensuring that these practices, gas flaring in the oil fields, are reduced?
Yeah, I'm just thinking too. I mean, of course, there's now a court case being brought by a family of a young man who died of leukemia. And mm-hmm. The health situation is really awful for people living in and around those gas fields. But you know, that is a dilemma, isn't it? The challenges are obvious. the solutions, as you say, are difficult, but there are solutions. And yet, this governance structure, this corrupt system, is such that the solutions are not forthcoming. Is that a fair take, or am I just being another negative naysayer, the no-hoper position?
No, I mean, any, you know, you've been watching, anyone who has been watching Iraq over the last 20 years will probably reach a similar conclusion. A country that has been engulfed in cycles and cycles of conflict and corruption and ultimately violence in so many different ways to its people seems to be the trajectory. I think there's something interesting. You know, I've just returned from Baghdad, and I was in Sulaymaniyah as well and other parts. And there is, I think Iraq is going through a moment right now. The oil price is high. In general terms, internally, there isn't an insurgency or the kind of terrorist attacks that have become so common in the last 20 years. And you have a government that's just pushing through with development, right? So the government of the prime, you know, the prime minister, Mohamed Ishaq Sudani, and his government are, you know, taking the money that's there and just investing in building bridges, building a metro, building all of, there's all of these ideas. And so far, you know, it seems like people are of approving this. People are saying, wait a minute, is this different? Can this government actually take us on a different trajectory? I mean, Erdogan was in Baghdad a few days ago, the Turkish president, and there was all of these agreements reached. Sudani has also went to DC a few weeks ago and reached all these agreements. Qatar, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, you have a lot of development happening. There's almost a corridor being built that could connect the region in a very interesting way. And at the heart of that is Iraq, you know. And so we think and sort of we question, is this the opportunity to divert Iraq off of the trajectory of which we've known for the last 20 years and onto something different? So I would say that we are in a moment there. But of course, you know, to go back to your point on the negative naysayer, many of the roots of the conflict, whether it is the corruption or it is the fact that the prime minister is unable to control the sovereignty of his country, the fact that even a few days ago, Adana gas field was hit by drones killing workers there, coming likely from Iran-allied groups. The fact that the prime minister doesn't have sovereignty, the corruption is still rampant. The fact that, you know, other internal dynamics between the Kurds, you know, the KDP and Baghdad central government, or between the Sunnis and the speaker and the Baghdad government are still there, really mean that, you know, fundamentally, this is a sort of country on autopilot because of a high oil price. But those roots of the problem still remain. And so the question really is how the government can just move away from that trajectory, which we've known it to be on.
Yeah, you make a good point about the oil price, because as you say, it's closing in on $90 a barrel. But what happens if that slipped to 60? I mean, the forecasts are saying it probably won't in the short term, but it's a bit of a crapshoot, to use that particular analogy. You're listening to the Arab Digest podcast with me, William Law, and Renaud Mansour, Senior Research Fellow and the Project Director of the Iraq Initiative at London's Chatham House. Arab Digest is a truly independent voice on the Middle East and North Africa. No advertising and no sponsors. In the information overload world in which we all find ourselves, Arab Digest keeps it simple. One insightful article a day, and the weekly podcast from top experts, analysts, writers, and commentators. Here at Arab Digest, we have put together a team of contributors you'll not find anywhere else. When you go to the website, be sure and look out for the offer of a free 2-month trial to our reader-supported daily newsletter. You know, just going back to the Iraq Initiative conference of last year, there was a mood of daring to believe that matters were starting to move possibly in the right direction. I'm hearing that again from you. And there was, you know, muted optimism that the government of Prime Minister Sudani was on that road, that optimistic road. I'm just wondering, you know, if you look at it, how is he doing? Because, my goodness, he's got huge obstacles in his way.
Yeah. And he's taken the approach of, you know, someone who doesn't want to get so lost in the web of politics and instead just wants to keep his head down and just almost like a project manager start building, you know, start engaging with projects, building bridges, building infrastructure, and hope the kind of the politics can sort of sort itself out. And that's very much his approach. And as I say, because the price of oil has been high, fundamentally, things are moving in a direction, I think, in which he is happy with, and the government is moving in that direction. But, you know, to kind of come back to that point, we're not seeing much change, right? So we're not, you know, even though the price of oil is high, there isn't thinking about economic diversification, for example. No, the government is still primarily giving public sector jobs, you know, each year. And that is a massive challenge moving forward. We're not seeing genuine anti-corruption drives. We're seeing anti-corruption certainly in a politicized way, but we're not seeing as much of a cleaning up as, you know, we would have hoped for some kind of accountable state. And there are many other trends that I think, you know, if you kind of dig deeper into, you'd begin to see that it very much still is a government gambling that the price of oil will stay high for the next few years, which would allow it to try and buy its way, buy its time, in essence.
Yeah, and you know, you just mentioned you were back in Baghdad, and you picked up on this mood of optimism that people are seeing something there, and that you can build on people's optimism.
That's right. Yeah, of course. And you know, I mean, what the politicians are saying there is, even if right now things aren't great, people are seeing that there is hope, that there is something in the future, whether it's a new bridge or it's a new metro system, right? There are signs that, you know, people are seeing which make them think, is this different to the past, you know, corrupt leaders that we've had? And so there is certainly a sense of optimism. It kind of reminds me of 2008, 9, 10, when, again, at that time, it was post-Civil War, the price of oil was high. You know, at the time, Nourdin Maliki was prime minister and was celebrated in a way, really supported by the US and others, but also domestically. And there was another window. So I guess the point here is that you do have these windows that emerge. And the history of Iraq is, you know, since 2003, is not a line, it's not linear, but it's cyclical. And in our conversations, and anyone who, you know, is working with the prime minister and the government right now, I think that is the question. How do we divert course and ensure that any progress we make right now, any optimism we make right now, we can channel into positive change that address the roots of conflict?
Yeah, and you did touch on, too, this business of the public sector jobs being doled out by various ministries and various factions wanting to grab a hold of various ministries, and that reinforces that that massive corruption structure. But there we are, finally we are in the US election year. Do you see Iraq factoring in any way at all, in any significant way? For example, if Trump wins, would he make the withdrawal of US forces, you know, would that be part of his campaign to secure a victory? Or do you think that Iraq is just somewhere back there and not really on the radar for most American voters?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the story today for most in the Middle East is more the, you know, obviously the Israel war in Gaza, but also the axis of resistance groups, which we've been talking about. And Iraq factors into that to some extent, having being part of that axis with some of the PMF groups. You know, there certainly is a bit of tension in Iraq as to what happens next, because although we've seen U.S. strikes in Iraq, Iraqi groups replying, you know, striking Americans, Kitab Hezbollah killing three American service people earlier this year, the relationship between the Biden administration and the Sudani administration has been relatively positive. As I said, Sudani was recently in Washington, and the two governments are continuing, even with the regional chaos, they are continuing with what they're calling the sort of change of the relationship. They want to, what they call, normalize the Iraqi-US relationship and turn into a bilateral relationship, which is not only security or military related, but goes into economics, culture, and other portfolios. And we've seen a lot of you know, at least in these early days and early stages, a lot of progress. They're building different working groups and they have very good dialogue and, you know, discussions between each other. So there is a kind of apprehension of, you know, if this changes and the Trump a new Trump administration comes in. Of course, it was the Trump administration that carried such a maximalist approach to Iran, where, you know, that led Iraq to become a battleground between the two countries. And quite literally, the Trump decision to kill Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis continues to have massive ripple effects in the region when it comes to the conflict between the axis of resistance and the US. So I would say that, you know, it's certainly a wild card, and there certainly is apprehension from many of the return of a Trump administration, at least when it comes to those in Baghdad and what that would mean. Those close to the Trump administration are most worried that the Sudani government is, you know, has some allies that are very close to Iran, some who are designated terrorists according to the US. And so there will be a much harder line coming from a Trump administration than from the Biden administration, which up until now has in different ways tried to move forward with the dialogue process.
Now, I'll throw one final thought at you, Renaud. It just occurred to me, we're talking about the axis of resistance. Do you remember the axis of evil? It was Iraq, Iran, and North Korea, I think. Anyway, mm-hmm. axis of resistance is it's sort of a kind of clever rebranding, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. Yeah, no, and that's it, right? I mean, this is, yeah, and that was also an important moment, right? Because at that time, if you remember, again, the U.S. administration, sorry, the Iranian administration, the government Khatami was opening up to the U.S. I think he had gone on CNN at the time as well and tried to say we want open relations. And then Iran was put into this camp with Saddam Hussein and North Korea as well. And so, you know, it is, I think, a clever way of them to basically say, we've tried so many times in their way to negotiations, but fundamentally, we will resist. We will resist America and its allies because they have done us no good. Although, ironically, the U.S. decision to remove Saddam Hussein was one of the best things that would happen to Iran's policy in Iraq as well as the region. But nonetheless, I think that Iran-U.S. conflict stemming back to 1979, 1980, of course, the Islamic Revolution, as well as the hostage crisis, continues to have an impact and influence today's Middle East.
Yes, it certainly does. Well, Renaud, thank you. Thank you so much. And I'm sure we'll pick this conversation up just a little down the road.
It's great to be back, Bill. Thanks so much.
My guest today on the Arab Digest podcast was Renaud de Mansour, Senior Research Fellow and the Project Director of the Iraq Initiative at London's Chatham House. You'll have noticed we bring you the podcast with no advertising and no sponsors. We are a truly independent source for analysis and commentary on the Middle East and South Africa. If you'd like to support our independent voice, head to our website at arabdigest.org. Where you can find out about our reader-supported daily newsletter and how to get a free two-month trial. The newsletter features the very best of MENA analysts, commentators, and writers, contributors like Renaud. Check us out on arabdigest.org. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn, and search our library of more than 200 podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, SoundCloud, or Amazon. Our podcast guests provide unique insights, insights you simply will not find anywhere else. Thanks for listening. I'm William Law, editor of the Arab Digest, essential reading, essential listening from independent sources.